Welcome to Ideas. I'm Paul Kennedy. We're coming to you from the Chan Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We're here for the 2008 Multiculturalism Lecture, which is co-sponsored by UBC, the Laurier Institution, and CBC Radio. More than 700 people are in the hall on an evening in April to hear Will Kimlicka, one of Canada's and the world's foremost thinkers on democracy and diversity, tell the story of multiculturalism in Canada. Will Kimlicka is Canada Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University. He's written 6 books, the most recent called Multicultural Odysseys, Navigating the New International Politics of Diversity. He calls his talk here at the Chan Center, The 3 Lives of Multiculturalism. Will Kimlicka.
My lecture tonight is on the prospects for multiculturalism in Canada today. And I think it's clear that Canada faces challenges around issues of diversity that were not recognized or even contemplated when the policy was first adopted in 1971. And many commentators think that it's time to move on to a different framework for thinking about diversity. Even people who had supported multiculturalism in earlier years have started to wonder whether it's time to give multiculturalism a dignified burial, as one commentator put it, and to shift to a new post-multicultural approach. My own view is that multiculturalism still has some life left in it, still has some potential to contribute to building a better Canada, and that's what I want to argue tonight. Of course, the policy has to adapt, as all public policies do, but I'm cautiously optimistic that multiculturalism can and will adapt to meet those new challenges. So, just to give a brief sketch of the argument, I'll suggest that we can distinguish 3 stages in the evolution of multiculturalism. In its initial incarnation, it was a policy based on the logic of ethnicity. That is, it encouraged the self-organization and representation and participation of groups defined on ethnic lines in terms of country of origin. Starting in the mid to late 1970s and 80s, a second track was added, which dealt with issues of race and racial discrimination. And more recently, we've seen a third stage, which deals with claims based on religion. And groups organized along religious lines are fighting to get a seat at the table of multiculturalism. So we have 3 distinctive types of diversity at play in the multiculturalism policy: ethnicity, race, and religion. And some commentators worry that the combination of these 3 different types of diversity has just created a kind of incoherent hodgepodge of approaches that don't work, and that it's time to start over again. I think it's true, actually, that the evolution of the policy in these 3 stages was quite ad hoc and full of contingencies and accidents. But I want to suggest that that has actually been a strength of the policy and has given it greater potential to deal with the challenges we face. At least that's what I want to argue tonight. My main concern and main motivation is to think about the future of multiculturalism in Canada. But in order to explain that, I need to say a few words about the history, and particularly these first 2 stages based on ethnicity and race, and why I think they provide us with a good starting point for dealing with the new challenges of politicized religion. I should say that I'm going to focus almost exclusively on the federal policy of multiculturalism tonight. It's very important to remember that multiculturalism in Canada is not exclusively a federal government policy. There are multiculturalism policies at the provincial level in virtually every province in Canada. And there are also multiculturalism policies at the municipal level here in Vancouver and in many other Canadian cities. And indeed, multiculturalism policies have been adopted by a wide range of civil society organizations, universities, corporations, churches, unions, and others. And that's all actually, I think, testament to the way in which multiculturalism has taken root in Canada. What the socialists used to call the long march through the institutions has taken place here in Canada. So multiculturalism is not today, if it ever was, simply a top-down edict from Ottawa that we all have to obey. It is something that has been embraced by many important actors within Canadian society. So it's important to remember that there's a much bigger story of multiculturalism in Canada, but for tonight I'm going to focus on the federal dimension of it, partly just because it provides a very clear indication of these three stages, but also because, in a sense, it provides the larger legislative and indeed constitutional framework within which those more local developments take place. Okay, so let's start with that first stage of multiculturalism. What were the original goals of the policy when it was adopted in 1971? That's a complicated question, but to oversimplify, let me focus on what I take to be the two key goals of the original policy, which are national unity and human rights. Multiculturalism is basically a component of a larger political bargain about how to keep the country together, whose main component was the issue of Quebec separatism. Starting in the early 1960s, as you all know, there was a resurgence of Quebec nationalism, including the first real stirrings of a separatist movement. And the federal government was concerned that it had to do something in order to stop that development. It had to do something in order to reaffirm the loyalty and attachment of Quebecers to Canada. And so it decided to adopt a whole series of reforms that were intended to strengthen the duality of Canada, the French-English duality of Canada. And that included reaffirming the importance of the two founding nations, as they were described, strengthening official bilingualism, and other symbolic recognitions of duality in Canada, one of which was the formation of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which had the mandate precisely to recommend to the government what kinds of specific measures should it take to enhance the French-English duality of Canada. As soon as the mandate of the Royal Commission was announced in 1963, a number of long-established ethnic groups, particularly the Ukrainians, but also Poles and Germans and Dutch and others, were worried about the mandate of this Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. They were worried that in the efforts to accommodate Quebec, it was going to be the ethnic groups who were going to pay the price of accommodating Quebec nationalism, that in the name of affirming duality, that ethnic groups were going to be pushed to the margin, that the French and the British in Canada were just going to divide up the country between the two of them in terms of public offices, public space, symbols, and so on, and that the important contribution that these long-settled ethnic groups had made was going to be ignored, and they were going to be marginalized in Canadian political life. And so that was the first real origins of what's sometimes called the third force political mobilization by ethnic groups in Canada. And they were mobilizing against the mandate of the Royal Commission. And the federal government was very nervous about this. It believed that it had to adopt these reforms based on duality in order to deal with Quebec. And it was surprised and worried by the level of resistance that ethnic groups were posing and challenging the ability of the government to pass these reforms to deal with Quebec. And so the federal government came up with a bargain. It said to the ethnic groups, if you stop opposing the commission and if you stop opposing bilingualism, we will guarantee you a certain level of recognition and accommodation through a multiculturalism policy. And so the formulation that was developed was multiculturalism within a bilingual framework. And that slogan is the basis for the 1971 policy. It's essentially multiculturalism is, if you like, a kind of afterthought that was attached to an already existing set of reforms to deal with Quebec in order to make sure that those reforms could be adopted and sustained with the sufficient levels of public support. That may sound like a rather crude account of a policy that many people have taken to heart. I think it's more or less the correct account of the historical origins of the policy. I should also say that I think it's a very successful political bargain. It's been a very stable one. In fact, I'd say it's the only basis on which Canada can survive as a country, that Canada will not survive unless we are able to affirm the French-English duality through very strong official bilingualism, but we're not going to be able to maintain public support in Canada for that sort of duality and bilingualism unless we can assure those who are not of British and French origins that the accommodation of Quebec is not coming at their expense. And so something like multiculturalism within a bilingual framework is, I think, the basis for national unity in Canada. And I think that explains why that bargain was not just reaffirmed but constitutionalized in the 1982 Constitution. I think there's a clear recognition by federal policymakers that there is no alternative for keeping the country together. We can actually, if you like, think about the 1995 referendum as the flip side of this bargain, that, as you all know, The separatists in Quebec came within 1% of breaking up the country during that referendum. If you ask who was the deciding vote, it was immigrants in Quebec. If they had not voted overwhelmingly against separation, the referendum would have passed and the country would have broken up. So, and that shows that immigrants accept this political bargain, that the image of multiculturalism within a bilingual framework is one that is a powerful one for many in Canada. And so if we think of multiculturalism as a kind of bribe that was paid to ethnic groups to reduce their opposition to bilingualism, I would say that bribe was repaid with interest in the immigrants' vote in the 1995 referendum. Okay, so that's the first impulse behind the policy, is it's part of a larger package around national unity. But that kind of crass bargain story neglects the role that a number of values and principles played in the policy. In fact, I think the policy could not have been adopted in the form it took if it did not resonate in certain ways with the values and aspirations of Canadian society at that moment in time, which was, if you think about the period between 1965 and 1975, this was a period of intense social and political reform in Canada, processes of liberalization. This was a period in which there was the liberalization of contraception laws and of abortion laws. It was the decriminalization of homosexuality, the abolition of the death penalty, the creation of human rights commissions at the federal level and across the country. This is a period of time that people call the human rights revolution in Canada, or the triumph of civil rights liberalism. And multiculturalism, I think, is very much part of that ethos of liberalization that swept Canada during that decade. That what all of these reforms have in common is that they are all about challenging the inherited inequalities, stigmatizations, discrimination that had created second-class citizens of different groups in Canadian society, and that limited the ability of individuals to lead the kinds of lives they chose. And right from the start, multiculturalism was understood by the government as part of that larger human rights revolution. So just to give you an example, let me quote from Pierre Trudeau's own statement of the multiculturalism policy when he introduced it to Parliament in 1971. He said that, and I quote, "A policy of multiculturalism within a bilingual framework is basically the conscious support of individual freedom of choice. We are free to be ourselves," end of quote. Of course, that's exactly the same argument he also gave for decriminalizing homosexuality and for liberalizing contraception and abortion laws. He was a deep defender of individual freedom of choice, and he viewed multiculturalism as part of that larger package of liberalizing reforms. And that idea is reaffirmed in the 1988 Multiculturalism Act. If you look at the preamble to the Act, which explains why Canada is creating a Multiculturalism Act, it says that the multiculturalism policy emerges out of Canada's commitment to civil liberties, and in particular, and I quote again, "the freedom of individuals to make the life that the individual is able and wishes to have." So it is explicitly stated in the original policy and in the 1988 Act that multiculturalism is part of a broader commitment to individual freedom and emancipation. Okay, so one way to think of it is that there was this very strong human rights impulse that was sweeping through Canadian society between 1965 and 1975, and the multiculturalism is an application and extension of that impulse to the issue of ethnic diversity. And in my view, this too remains as relevant today as the political pact that linked multiculturalism with bilingualism. That the question of how to deal with issues of ethnic diversity within a larger human rights context, to my mind, remains the right framework to think about issues of diversity in Canada, that a human rights framework is the only morally acceptable and politically feasible way for thinking about issues of ethnic diversity. So both of these two first impulses in my mind, the national unity impulse for multiculturalism and the human rights impulse, I think are as valid today as they were in 1971 and remain important components of multiculturalism.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, and around the world on cbc.ca. This Ideas episode is coming to you from the Chan Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of the University of British Columbia. Will Kimlicka, Canada Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University, is giving the 2008 Multiculturalism Lecture, sponsored by UBC, the Laurier Institution, and CBC Radio. His talk is called The Three Lives of Multiculturalism. Here he is again with the next part of his lecture.
Almost as soon as the policy had been adopted in 1971, new challenges emerged that had not been foreseen when the policy was first adopted. As I said, the original claims for multiculturalism came from long-settled ethnic groups, the Ukrainians, the Poles, the Germans, the Dutch, and these were all European ethnic groups. They were what we colloquially call the white ethnics. Non-European immigrant groups did not play a significant part in the debate around the B&B Commission or in the initial mobilization for multiculturalism, and that's largely the result of the fact, of course, that we had racially discriminatory immigration laws until the mid-1960s that kept them out of the country. And so it was only after 1965 that we started to get significant inflows of non-European immigrants, and it took several years for them to become politically active in the multiculturalism debate. But by the mid-1970s, quite shortly after the policy was adopted, they did become active players in the multiculturalism debate. And it quickly became clear that they faced very different challenges from those that were at stake in the original policy, that new immigrants from Jamaica or Vietnam faced different challenges than those of Ukrainians who'd been living in Canada for 50 years or, in many cases, second or third generation Ukrainian Canadians. And in particular, they faced two different kinds of challenges that were new. One sort of challenge was that they are precisely newcomers, and so they have challenges relating to the very first stages of settlement and integration, which had already passed for the European ethnic groups who'd mobilized initially for the policy. But also, and more importantly, these non-European groups were racial minorities and therefore faced forms of racial discrimination which had not really been relevant for European ethnic groups. It's of course true that many European ethnic groups faced prejudice and stereotypes. My father, who came from Czechoslovakia, certainly had many stories about encountering prejudice on the basis of his Slavic origins. But in terms of the global color line, in the 19th and 20th centuries, the world was restructured on the basis of an ideology of white racial supremacy. That was the basis of European imperialism and colonization of the rest of the world, as well as of the racially discriminatory immigration policies domestically. And in relation to that global ideology of European racial supremacy, the East European and Northern European ethnic groups were beneficiaries of the global color line, and newer non-European immigrant groups were the victims of that ideology. And that created challenges of integration and barriers to integration that these new immigrants faced that older European immigrants did not face. So these are the two new challenges that were being raised by the increasing inflow of non-European immigrant groups. And the question was whether multiculturalism could adapt to deal with these new challenges. And so could a policy initially designed to deal with long-settled white ethnic groups shift to deal with the challenges raised by newly arrived non-European immigrants? And there were many people who were skeptical about the ability of multiculturalism to make that shift. I think that shift did take place. It was not an easy shift. It took quite a while. But the policy has successfully adapted to deal with these two new challenges. But it was a very difficult process, in part because these new challenges raised questions about the very organizing logic of the policy. As I said before, the first stage of multiculturalism was based on the logic of ethnicity. It encouraged self-organization of groups defined by country of origin, like, say, the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. But it's clear that that mode of self-organization is not sufficient to deal with issues of racism. That if you think about immigrants from the Caribbean, someone is not discriminated on the grounds that they came from Jamaica rather than Trinidad. Most white Canadians probably can't distinguish someone whether they're from Jamaica or Trinidad. They're discriminated against on the grounds that they're black, on the basis of their skin color and on the basis of legacies of these long-standing ideologies of racial supremacy and inferiority. And similarly, too, with East Asians, that in many cases people aren't discriminated against on the grounds that they're Korean rather than Chinese, which many people would have trouble distinguishing, they're discriminated on the grounds of their skin color, that they're Asians or Orientals. And so the logic of ethnicity does not provide an effective remedy for dealing with issues of racism. And to its credit, the federal government very quickly realized this and so encouraged the formation of groups defined along lines of racialization and to deal with issues of anti-racism. For example, the Urban Alliance on Race Relations or the National Organization of Immigrant and Visible Women, that the federal government encouraged those kinds of organizations whose mandate was to organize people along racial lines to deal with issues of anti-racism. However, and this is the key point for me, when the government made that decision, it did not stop funding for ethnic organizations. It built support for anti-racism organizations on top of the ongoing policy of supporting ethnic organizations. And not just ongoing support for older ethnic organizations, like the Ukrainian Canadian Congress, it also encouraged newer immigrants to also organize along an ethnic line. So it encouraged the Jamaicans to have Jamaican organizations, the Trinidadians to have Trinidad and Tobago organizations, or the National Federation of Canadian Pakistanis, and so on. So it encouraged simultaneously organization on issues of racism on a pan-racial basis and ethnic organizations. Now, this is a very controversial decision, and many people think it was the wrong decision. Many people think that the emphasis should have been put entirely on the anti-racism struggle and that the encouraging of ethnic self-organization was a distraction, that encouraging the Jamaicans and Trinidadians to organize their own ethnic groups was at best a distraction from the real struggle, which is around racism, and at worst may in fact have been a deliberate attempt to distract attention from racism, that this is a kind of divide-and-conquer strategy, that if the Trinidadians and the Jamaicans are busy in their own separate ethnic groups, it'll make it more difficult for them to coalesce in effective anti-racism alliances. In my view, there's certainly much more that can and should do to fight racism, but I believe that the decision to maintain ethnicity along with race was the right one for Canada. I see no evidence that anti-racism policies are more effective in the absence of multiculturalism support for ethnic organizations. If you think about countries that did put all of their focus on anti-racism, that's the American model. They provide all sorts of support for struggles against racism and encourage people to organize as racial groups, but provide no public support for self-organization along ethnic lines. Britain is also quite similar. They have a very strong race relations program, but do not support ethnic self-organization. And in a different way, France also follows that model. It has anti-racism policies, but no support for ethnic self-organization. I think if we compare the Canadian policies against racism with those in the United States or Britain or France, I see no evidence that they're more effective in those other countries because they do not support ethnic self-organization. In fact, I think there's at least anecdotal evidence that support for ethnic self-organization can work hand-in-hand with struggles against racism and that they work best together. So, for example, there's a very interesting study done that compares the Vietnamese community in Boston and Toronto. And in both cities, the Vietnamese are very concerned about racism, and they want strong government action against racial discrimination. But they don't want to only participate in public life as members of a racial group defined by their skin color. They also have a strong sense of identification with their ethnic origin. They believe themselves to be the bearers of a distinctive cultural heritage, a language, religion, literature, national heroes, national holidays that they feel strongly attached to, and they want to be able to participate in public life as Vietnamese Canadians or Vietnamese Americans and not just as yellow-skinned Asians who are the victims of racial discrimination. And the study suggested that the Vietnamese in Toronto appreciated the fact that the Canadian government supports that kind of ethnic self-organization and representation alongside its anti-racism policies, and that the Vietnamese in Boston resent the fact that they're only encouraged to participate in public life on the basis of their skin color and not on the basis of their ethnic identity. And I think we can find comparable anecdotal evidence from comparing South Asian immigrant groups in Canada and Britain. There's been a bit of work on this, comparing, for example, Pakistanis in Canada and Britain. In Britain, they're encouraged to participate in the race relations framework, and that's important, But they also, they don't want to just be treated as a racial group defined by their skin color. They also want to participate as members of an ethnic group in a way that the Canadian policy allows for. Okay, so I think there is this ongoing danger that the support for ethnic self-organization will distract attention from anti-racism. That is a danger. But I believe the appropriate response to that danger is not to cancel support for ethnicity, but rather to identify and emphasize the ways in which the two policies can work together. Okay, so that's the first challenge that these new immigrant groups faced, was how to deal with racism. The other challenge that they raised was, as I said, the fact that they are literally newcomers whose immediate needs are often related to the very first stages of settlement and integration into Canada, unlike the Ukrainians or Poles who'd been here for 40 or 50 years. And so the multiculturalism policy had to, as it were, intervene earlier in the processes of immigrant settlement than had been initially planned or expected in the policy. The policy initially formulated assumed that immigrants had been here for a long time, like the Ukrainians, and assumed that they were all citizens. And for that reason, the policy is formulated, the original policy, as a policy about what it is to be a citizen. When the government adopted the policy in 1971, it assumed that all of the people demanding the policy, the Poles and the Ukrainians, were already citizens of Canada, and therefore the policy was about what does it mean to be a Canadian citizen. And the policy, in effect, said that one honorable way of being a good Canadian is to be a good Ukrainian Canadian, that one valuable way of contributing to Canadian society is to contribute through Polish-Canadian associations and organizations and so on. The policy was about how to understand what it means to be a Canadian on the assumption that these groups already were reasonably well integrated into Canada. They were certainly all citizens. And the question was, what does citizenship mean? What does it mean to be a Canadian? And what are the different ways that we can all be Canadian together? But with these new groups, many of them were not yet citizens. And the policy needed to adapt to deal with how to, rather than assuming that they're already well integrated, how do we help facilitate the initial steps of settlement and integration and naturalization into Canada. And that's a shift that has taken place such that today, when many people think about multiculturalism, they think about it almost exclusively in the context of newcomer integration. People think about multiculturalism as being kind of social service provision in relation to newcomers, even though that's very different from the initial policy. But even as that shift took place, the policy retained the focus on ideas of citizenship. And I think this is very important, and in a way it's very distinctive of the Canadian experience. If you think about other multiculturalism in other countries, think about Germany, for example. There was a kind of multiculturalism policy in Germany, but it was not understood as an attribute of German citizenship. It was, on the contrary, understood as an alternative to German citizenship. Immigrants to Germany were not able to become citizens. There were very, very restrictive naturalization rules. So the German government said, we don't want you as citizens, but as a consolation prize, we'll give you multiculturalism, which will make your life a bit more bearable here in Germany. And so there was no multicultural conception of German citizenship. It remained homogeneous, assimilationist, but multiculturalism was adopted as an alternative to German citizenship. So in Germany, multiculturalism is a policy for foreigners. It's a policy for aliens. In Canada, multiculturalism was a policy for citizens, because the people who originally demanded it were already citizens and was therefore necessarily a policy about how to reconstruct ideas of Canadian citizenship. And even as the policy extended to deal with the very first stages of immigrant settlement, it retained the idea that multiculturalism is first and foremost an account of what it is to be a Canadian. And so that even when it dealt with people who had not yet become Canadian citizens, the goal of the multiculturalism policy was to facilitate people's integration into a multicultural conception of Canadianness. So multiculturalism was not just a transition you go through until you become a real Canadian who doesn't need multiculturalism. Rather, multiculturalism, even when it was dealing with non-citizens, had as its goal integrating people into a multicultural conception of citizenship, such that no matter how long they've lived in Canada, and for their children and grandchildren, the conception of what it means to be a Canadian is one that recognizes and accommodates people's ethnic identities and ethnic allegiances and ethnic organizations. And I think, again, that this was the right decision. Some people thought that multiculturalism should focus almost exclusively on the very first stages of immigrant integration. That's where the most urgent needs were, and should cut these more fancy ideas of multicultural citizenship and should just focus on immigrant integration. But in my view, a multicultural conception of immigrant integration works best when it's linked with a multicultural conception of citizenship as the goal of integration. And that otherwise, the idea of multiculturalism doesn't provide an effective way of challenging assimilationist and homogenizing ideas of citizenship. And that's what we're seeing in Europe today in the backlash against multiculturalism. Because in Europe it was mainly seen as a transitional phenomenon, it was something you went through before you became a real Danish or Dutch or German person, that the fact that immigrants, even after they'd naturalized, continued to express ethnic identities was seen as evidence that they'd somehow not really integrated, not really become real citizens. And that has fed a backlash against multiculturalism. And if we want to avoid that poisonous dynamic here in Canada, I think it's important to emphasize that the kind of integration we're looking for is towards a multicultural conception of citizenship in which ethnicity is a legitimate part of what it means to be a Canadian citizen. Okay, so if we look at these first two stages of multiculturalism, we can see on the one hand dramatic transformations, but also very important continuities. So at one level, the policy went through a 180-degree shift. It started being a policy about accommodating the ethnic identities of long-settled white ethnics, and it became a policy for helping to integrate newly arrived non-European immigrants as the main focus of the policy. And that's a dramatic shift. But at another level, the original goals of the policy remained secure. They remained the foundation of the policy, and these new issues were built on top of it. And the result of this complex evolution by the end of the 1980s was a policy that had a number of very interesting and complicated interconnections. And just to summarize, I've sort of highlighted four of them. That we developed a policy by the late 1980s that was about the accommodation of diversity, but situated the accommodation of diversity within the context of national unity and French-English bilingualism, within the context of human rights, within the context of anti-racism, and within the context of Canadian citizenship. Now, in my view, each of those linkages is crucially important, that insofar as Canada has had any success in our diversity policies, it's because of the way we have connected the accommodation of diversity to national unity, human rights, anti-racism, and citizenship. And that those, to my mind, remain essential to any successful approach to diversity in Canada, and that it would be, in my view, a very serious mistake to shift to a post-multicultural age if it meant abandoning any of those four linkages.
You're listening to Will Kimlicka, Canada Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University, discussing the three lives of multiculturalism. He's giving the 2008 Multiculturalism Lecture at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at the University of British Columbia. I'm Paul Kennedy with Ideas, heard in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. Now back to Will Kimlicka and the final part of his talk.
Okay, so those are the first two stages of multiculturalism. And I think we can say that by the end of the late 1980s, they had consolidated. We had a fairly consolidated policy of multiculturalism that's reflected in the passage of the Multiculturalism Act in 1988, which reaffirmed all of those four linkages that I mentioned. They're all clearly stated in the Multiculturalism Act, and which was adopted with a cross-party political consensus, which reflected how strongly this policy had become embedded in Canadian political life. But no sooner had that policy been adopted, the Multiculturalism Act been adopted in 1988, than we had a new set of challenges that arose that was not expected or contemplated when the Act was adopted. And these are fundamentally claims around the politicization of religion, which had not been an important component of either of the first two stages of multiculturalism. So as a paradigm case, think about the Somali Canadians that On the one hand, like every other immigrant group, Somali Canadians have wanted to self-organize on an ethnic basis, and there's a Somali Canadian Congress that represents them as an ethnic group. They've also been very concerned about anti-racism and so participate in various racial alliances to deal with anti-black racism. But they also want to participate in Canadian life as Muslims and have wanted to take part in the multiculturalism policy on the basis of their religious identity in association with Muslims of other ethnic and racial origins. So this emergence of claims-making and self-organization on a religious lines is, as I say, it's a relatively new phenomenon in the Canadian multiculturalism context, and I think it defines what I'm calling the third stage of multiculturalism, which we're still very much in the middle of working our way through, which is a source of a great deal of anxiety for many people. It's important to ask why it's emerged, and that too is a very complicated question. I think there are a number of reasons why we've seen this emergence of faith-based claims as part of the multiculturalism story in Canada. Part of it is that this is not just a Canadian story. There is a global resurgence of the politicization of religion. Think about the evangelical Christians in the United States, or Hindu movements in India, or the rise of political movements amongst Buddhists in Sri Lanka, and of course the rise of Islamist political parties and movements in many countries. So it's a global phenomenon, and there was no reason to think that Canada would be exempt from it. But it's important to recognize that the increasing desire of people to participate in groups organized along religious lines is not just amongst the devout. There's a very interesting phenomenon by which even those people who are secular are often interested in participating in groups defined along religious lines. So consider, for example, the children of Muslim immigrants to Canada. So think about a student here at UBC. Let's imagine that their parents emigrated from Pakistan, that they may well on campus here have a choice. They could participate. There might be a Pakistani-Canadian student association, and there might be a Muslim student association. And you might think that if the student is secular, they'd participate in the Pakistani association, and if they're devout, they'd participate in the Muslim association. But in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence from Canada and from many other Western democracies that younger Muslim children of immigrants, even if they're secular, are preferring to participate in groups defined along religious lines rather than ethnic lines, that they feel a stronger sense of identification with the Muslim world than with a particular ethnic group or country of origin, feel a stronger sense of solidarity with their co-religionists than with co-ethnics. And so both amongst the devout and amongst the secular, there has been, at least in some contexts, a growing desire to participate in groups defined along religious lines. So those are, if you like, bottom-up reasons for increasing participation and politicization of religious groups. But there are also top-down reasons. That is, that the government of Canada has an increasing desire in talking to the Muslims. This is particularly true since 9/11, that the Canadian government is very concerned to find out what's going on amongst the Muslim community in Canada. And so it wants to create mechanisms of communication and consultation and dialogue and deliberation. It wants to find out who can speak for the Muslim community, who can tell them what's going on. And so so both for bottom-up reasons and for top-down reasons, there's been a desire to add to the multiculturalism story this third track of religion, in which there would be organization and representation and participation of groups defined along religious lines on top of pre-existing mechanisms based on race and ethnicity. And so, as I say, this is the third wave of multiculturalism as I see it, and it raises a number of very delicate and difficult issues, and there's a lot of questions and concerns about whether the multiculturalism policy can adapt to deal with this new set of challenges. I am cautiously optimistic that multiculturalism can and should adapt to deal with claims of religious groups. In my view, that the basic framework that has evolved for multiculturalism, which, as I said, is accommodating diversity in the context of national unity, human rights, anti-racism, and citizenship, that is a helpful framework for thinking about issues of diversity generally, not just ethnicity and race, but also religion. and that the arguments that have been developed over the years in support of multiculturalism in the context of ethnicity and race also apply, in many cases, to the issues of religion, that like ethnic and racial minorities, religious minorities in Canada have been the victims of discrimination and prejudice and stigmatization, both explicit state-sponsored discrimination and also very broad informal forms of discrimination and prejudice, and that the models of recognition and accommodation and consultation and deliberation that have developed in the context of ethnic and racial groups, I think, can be extended to issues of religion. So as I said, I'm cautiously optimistic that we can draw on our experience with the first two waves to deal constructively with the third wave. Of course, there are all sorts of difficulties that emerge. One obvious question is, I mean, how do you decide who you should consult with when the government wants to talk to the Muslim community? Who does it decide which groups should it talk to? Who does it decide who speaks for whom, who represents whom? How does it make sure that it's getting an inclusive picture of what's going on within the Muslim community and not just listening to the elders or the patriarchs, but also listening to the voices of women or youth? Those are obviously profound questions, but note, they're not distinctive to the religious tract. The same questions arose in relation to the ethnicity and the racial tract, and the Multiculturalism Office in Ottawa has a long experience of trying to get more inclusive consultation and deliberation, not just with self-proclaimed leaders and elites, but to try to create mechanisms of communication that reach out to, in the broadest possible way, to the broader members of the community. So I think there are lessons from our earlier experiences that we can draw on. Many people also feel anxiety about this third stage of multiculturalism because they worry that the content of the claims that religious groups are making are a potential threat to our liberal democratic values. I mentioned earlier that one of the core impulses of the multiculturalism policy was a liberal impulse. Multiculturalism was understood by Pierre Trudeau, as was Brian Mulroney in 1988, as a policy of enhancing the freedom of individuals to lead the kind of lives they choose. But there's a worry that some of the claims being made by religious groups are not ones that are going to enhance the freedom of individuals to lead the lives they choose, but rather enhance the power of some people within the group to tell other people within the group how to lead their lives and thereby restrict the freedom of the weaker or more vulnerable members of religious groups. And when this concern is raised, a number of stock examples are given. I'm sure you're all familiar with them. Examples like female genital mutilation or forced arranged marriages of young girls or honor killings. And one could have imagined, people have worried, that conservative religious leaders might invoke multiculturalism to justify those practices. I think we now have a long enough experience in Canada to know that, that has not happened. No religious or ethnic group has attempted to gain legal recognition of the right to engage in female genital mutilation or forced marriages or honor killings. On the contrary, if we think about the main claims that religious groups have advanced in the name of multiculturalism, I think they do more or less fit with the image of being policies that enhance individual freedom. They've been primarily about trying to adapt public institutions to facilitate the participation of people of different religious faiths. So, for example, allowing Sikhs to wear the turban in the RCMP, or allowing women to wear the hijab, or recognition of religious holidays in school calendars, or provision of halal food in public institutions. These are all forms of religious accommodation that are not a threat to anyone's individual freedom. They're, on the contrary, ways of enhancing individual freedom in just the ways that I think Trudeau intended in the multiculturalism policy. So at least to date, I think, most of the claims that have been advanced in the name of religion do fit within the broader liberal human rights agenda of the multiculturalism policy, rather than being demands to gain legal recognition for illiberal practices. Having said that, figuring out where exactly the boundaries of accommodation should be is a very difficult question. So consider, for example, the issue of the funding of religious schools, which was a very live issue in the last election in Ontario. where I'm from, it was in fact the main issue in the provincial election. Many religious groups in Ontario have demanded public funding of religious schools, and it's a very difficult request to turn down, given that Ontario already provides public funding to Catholic schools, and it seems very strange that a government that's committed to equality and to multiculturalism would provide funding for Catholics and not for other religious groups. On the other hand, we know that some of the groups who are seeking public funding would use it to create schools that would teach intolerance and that would be hostile to ideas of gender equality or gay rights or indeed of multiculturalism. One of the paradoxes of the current situation is that one of the reasons why some groups want public funding of religious schools, one of the reasons why they want to take their kids out of common public schools, is because their kids are being exposed to multiculturalism in the public schools. They're being exposed to other ways of life, other faiths, and some conservative religious parents believe that that's encouraging skepticism or relativism, and so they want to take their kids out of the public schools, put them into faith-based schools in order to insulate them from multicultural education. And yet they're demanding that public funding of those schools in the name of multiculturalism. It's a bit of a paradox, and it's a bit of a problem. And so some people, some of those people who are defenders of liberal multiculturalism, were very strong opponents of the idea of the public funding of religious schools, and they believe that the only kind of schooling that can really teach liberal multiculturalism are common public schools. On the other hand, there is, as I say, the problem that we already have public funding of Catholic schools in Ontario, but in any event, in a free society, there will always be privately funded religious schools, and so we in any event have to find a way of trying to ensure that privately funded religious schools are able to educate children in a way that is consistent with human rights and tolerance. And if we are able to do that successfully, then maybe that means that we can also find a way of regulating publicly funded religious schools in a way that makes it consistent with the human rights aspirations of our multiculturalism policy. So that's a very difficult issue. It's completely unresolved in the Ontario context. It's an awkward issue that is a source of ongoing debate, not just in Ontario, but in many other provinces, and indeed in many other Western democracies. The issue of the place of religious education in liberal multiculturalism is a deep, difficult, and unresolved issue. And I think we could say the same thing about another issue that came up recently in Ontario concerning faith-based arbitration of family law issues. And I don't have time to rehearse the details of that debate, but a very similar set of issues. Some people think that we need to shut down private arbitration entirely because otherwise it provides a space in which illiberal inequalities will be perpetuated. But in a free society, there is always going to be quite a bit of scope for the private ordering of family relationships, and we need to find ways of trying to ensure that basic rights of individuals are respected in private arbitration, and a number of proposals have been made about how to ensure that that takes place, but it's unresolved in Ontario, as in many other Western democracies. And these are just two of many examples I could give where the claims of religious groups they're not explicitly and obviously in contradiction with basic human rights ideals, the way it would be if they were demanding the right to maintain honor killings, for example. But on the other hand, there are concerns at the margins about how these affect our basic commitments to individual freedom and human rights and gender equality, and we are working our way through these issues. And it's going to take time. And in my view, there is no magic formula. We just have to look at these case by case. And that some proposals for the public funding of religious education are, I think, quite consistent with the basic aspirations of the multiculturalism framework as it's developed. Some aren't. And so, too, with different models about the role of private arbitration in family law. And I just think we need to, as I say, take our time, work through these case by case, drawing as best we can on the experiences and lessons we've learned from the earlier two stages of multiculturalism. What worries me is that some people are looking for a shortcut to solve these issues. And the shortcut that many people have grabbed is the idea of secularism. that many people argue that unlike the first two stages of multiculturalism, the very idea of making claims on the basis of religion is inherently antithetical to the secular basis of a liberal democratic state. So that it was consistent with liberal democratic constitutionalism to have claims based on ethnicity and race. Those first two stages were fine as manifestations of a human rights-based multiculturalism, but religious-based claims are inherently in contradiction with the liberal impulse because they violate secularism. Now, in my view, this is a very serious mistake. One problem with it is it's a hypocritical argument, given the way in which Canadian government institutions have, for a very long period of time, made any number of accommodations of Christian and Jewish beliefs and practices, and that to all of a sudden invoke secularism as a reason for suppressing anything that Muslims ask for smacks of double standards and inconsistencies. But more generally, I think there's a conceptual mistake in saying that secularism provides a knockdown argument or a veto against faith-based multicultural claims. Secularism, as I understand the term, is the view that the state should not be in the business of ranking and evaluating different religious beliefs. It's not in the business of deciding which religion is superior to another, or of endorsing one religion over others, or of adopting one as the true religion. But it's perfectly consistent with secularism in that sense that a liberal state provide tax breaks to religious organizations, as Canada and as all Western democracies do. It's consistent with secularism in that sense to provide public funding to religious schools, as many Western democracies do. It's consistent with secularism to provide accommodations for religious belief in the form of exemptions from animal slaughtering laws or, as I say, exemptions from dress codes for the turban or skull caps or hijabs. It's consistent with secularism to provide social services through religious organizations, as we do in Ontario, as in many other provinces, hospitals, for example. So in my view, to think that secularism just provides this kind of hammer that you can use to reject all claims being advanced by religious organizations is a mistake. What is important, what we should think about, is the effect of these faith-based claims on basic human rights and on individual freedom. I think that's the framework that multiculturalism has used in the past to evaluate the claims of ethnic and racial groups, and I believe it's the right framework to evaluate the claims of religious groups. And as I said, if we apply that standard, I believe we'll find that some of the claims pass the test and some don't, and that we just have to, as I say, work through those issues case by case, and we need to take our time doing it. But I believe, as I said, that I think that the experiences and mechanisms that we've developed over the two previous stages of multiculturalism provide us with a good stepping stone for dealing with those issues, and that if we draw upon those in an informed and intelligent way, I believe we can take what is currently the challenge of dealing with religious diversity and turn it into an opportunity to create an even more inclusive conception of Canadian citizenship. Thank you.
On this episode of Ideas, the 2008 Multiculturalism Lecture by Will Kimlicka, Canada Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's University. The program was recorded in April at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at the University of British Columbia. The Multiculturalism Lecture is sponsored by UBC, the Laurier Institution, and CBC Radio. On the production team were Kathleen Flaherty, Chris Cutress, both in Vancouver, and Bernie Lucht and Dave Field in Toronto. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now for the hourly news.